Maybe we personally have carved out hiking trails. Or we planted damaged habitats. Or spent summer vacation digging wells, installing solar panels, or building schools. We tip the balance with the choices we make. It all starts with realizing that every travel decision is a choice, one with radiating impacts. A few key tips. For global and long-distance domestic travel, fly less. At present, there are no climate-neutral options, so fuel efficiency counts. Take the train if possible. Or a boat. Or a bus. When you absolutely need to fly, make the trip matter. No more one-week wonder tours of Europe or girlfriend getaway weekends in Hawaii. Even if you can afford that, the planet can't. When you do go big in terms of travel distance, stay a while. Stay long enough to get to know the place, its people, and life as they live it. Enjoy local food, drink, and events. Arrange accommodations for a week or a month, even a year, you retirees, and take long looping trips to explore. Give back. Buy local goods and services for starters, and otherwise make a meaningful contribution whenever you can. In other words, avoid frenetic, if it's Tuesday, this must be Denmark, tourism. Luxuriate in being unhurried. Practice slow travel in all its forms. Stop using travel as a means to get away from your life. Instead, plan trips to deepen and enrich it. Think quality of travel, not quantity. The writer Michael Pollan famously used just 7 words to tell us how to eat better. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. To translate that wisdom into travel advice takes just 6 words. Travel, not too much, mostly slow. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Tonight, we'll be discussing federal leasing for oil and gas extraction in Alaska. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse, exciting, and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, they're open Monday through Saturday from 11 to 9 with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, at 530-399-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. And we're also made possible by Chico Performances, presenting jazz at Lincoln Center, that will be performing Songs We Love, a musical journey through the history of jazz music from the 20s through the 50s. The world-renowned performers of jazz at Lincoln Center take the stage with 3 vocalists to celebrate the songs of the early jazz era made famous by Sinatra, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, and others. The concert is on January 24th in Laxon Auditorium. More information at chicoperformances.com. And we'll remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Just a couple of weeks ago, pre-Christmas, we did a program on caribou, a.k.a. Santa's reindeer, and threats to the land where they live in Alaska and Canada. We focus particularly on oil and gas extraction leases in the Alaska National Wild Refuge. The bad news being that auctions of those leases have been mandated. The better news is that the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, has put these on hold pending environmental evaluations.
Today, we'll be discussing another auction and another proposed set of leases, these in the Cook Inlet, which is south of Anchorage, Alaska. Our guest will be Sue Mauger. She's executive director of a community-based organization, Cook Inlet Keeper. It's a nonprofit that combines advocacy, education, and science toward its mission to protect Alaska's Cook Inlet watershed and the life it sustains. We'll take a short break. Be back to talk with Sue Mauger. That was Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, played over the loudspeaker of a fishing boat off the coast of Scotland. It sets the tone for our discussion this afternoon. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. As we've mentioned, we've been studying lease of public lands in Alaska for oil and gas extraction. We did a program recently fighting oil leases in the Alaska National Wildlife Reserve.
Today, our focus is on the Cook Inlet in Alaska, and our guest is Sue Mauger of Cook Inlet Keeper, an organization which joined with Earth Justice and others in filing suit to prevent a planned auction of oil and gas leases for the inlet. An auction did proceed in December 30th, and we'd like to hear about the outcome. Welcome, Sue Mauger.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Please describe the inlet for us before we get to the question of the leases. For those who don't know it, the geography, or where is it? How large is it? What's some of the wildlife and the land spaces?
Yes, thanks. Yes, Cook Inlet and its watershed is about 47,000 square miles, so the size of many of our eastern states. It is a watershed that drains the south flank of Denali, the highest mountain in North America, and then it also drains some other smaller ranges and has number of very large glaciers. We have some really big river systems like the Susitna, the Matanuska, and the Kenai rivers that are draining our mountains and then head into a very productive Cook Inlet. And Cook Inlet is also known as Takahatnu, which is the Dena Aina name for Cook Inlet, and I think it's the big river waters is Takahatnu. And these lands have been stewarded by the Dena Aina Supiak and peoples from long ago and time immemorial. So we live on a very rich place in terms of the people, and we also live in incredibly productive landscapes and waters. We have beluga whales here in Cook Inlet. We have sea otters and black bears and brown bears and seals and all of the fabulous wildlife you might hope to see if you ever dream of coming up to Alaska. We have also all five species of wild Alaskan salmon, all Pacific salmon, and we have really thriving local economies that are built around those fisheries and tourism, built around a lot of bird and bear viewing that goes on here. So it's a really spectacular place with, you know, real wildness in it still. And I'm down here on the lower part of the Cook Inlet watershed down in Homer. Mm-hmm. And we're on the beautiful Kachemak Bay is the waters that we look out on that then flow out into the lower Cook Inlet, which is where these leases that were just let by the federal government. The area that was just leased is in federal waters, which means that it's 3 miles offshore. All the other waters in Cook Inlet are state waters, but as you get into the lower part of the inlet where it gets much wider, we get into federal waters.
Mm-hmm. So how many people live in that area? Which is, yeah, you said, so, the site of,
yeah,
like,
we're
this.
The biggest area in, okay, Alaska. So this is South Central Alaska, and there's about 400,000 people living in South Central Alaska. Anchorage sits sort of nestled between the two arms of Cook Inlet, so Turnagain Arm and Kinnick Arm. Anchorage, the largest city in Alaska, is nestled in there. Mm-hmm. And then we have, north of Anchorage, we have a really rapidly growing region in the Matanuska, so Sitna Basin. And then we're down here on the Kenai Peninsula, mm-hmm, and there's about, I think it's around 75,000 people live down here on the Kenai Peninsula. So we have both urban environment and very rural. We have communities that are only accessed by boat or plane, mm-hmm, so limited roads and such. It is very diverse. We have a really diverse population in Anchorage, as well as communities. There's 10 tribal communities all across Cook Inlet, and we also have Russian Old Believer communities. So it is a surprisingly diverse,
yes,
area up here.
We took a cruise ship to Anchorage, but we also have a little background. Susan's brother, Mike, had a business in the Kenai Peninsula, and mm-hmm, I had a chance to visit him then. We also bicycled in Anchorage and saw mooses grazing right off the bike path. It was a big thrill,
yep,
for tourists.
Be careful about those mooses. They'll chase you down.
Yeah, yeah, they said, yeah, keep your distance. You're walking a little. There was a local there, and he said, back off. Don't walk any closer. And so, yeah, we learned, yeah, quickly that they're not, you know, cows.
Right. Not at all. No. Yeah. And you know, we have so many public lands in our watershed. We have places like Katmai National Park, which is known for its bears. There's Lake Clark, Denali. We have a couple of, we have the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. Like, it's a really, the McNeil Bear Sanctuary. So lots of amazing wildness here, but there's plenty of wildlife you can see just walking down the streets in Anchorage.
Amazing. So amazing.
But there are already oil and gas leases in the inlet. They've been there for, as I understand, 16 years or more. Tell us about how that exploration has taken place in the past.
Sure. So, yeah, we've actually had oil and gas leasing. The state began to lease oil and gas in Cook Inlet in 1959, so 60-plus years.
Yeah.
And one of the things that has really kind of shaped our history here in the state is the relationship that oil and gas companies have with the state government, in that a huge part of our annual operating budget for the state is related to oil and gas royalties. So we have a relationship with the oil and gas industry where they have really wanted a lot of predictability. And so there has been a lot of effort by the legislature to make sure that there's annual sales in those state waters, and that there's subsidies to encourage more development. And so it's a very sort of complicated relationship with the oil and gas companies up here.
Then you have the former governor, Drill Baby Drill, and Senator Murkowski,
exactly,
who has said that this is vital to the state's fiscal health.
Yeah, right. And that, and, you know, we get, as many folks have heard of, our little permanent fund dividend we get every year. Every Alaskan who's been here for a year or more gets a check for some amount of money, determined every year based on how well things have done in the stock market and how much the legislation decides to allocate to our permanent fund dividends. So that can be a pretty significant amount of money. It's typically over $1,000. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, family of four or five, that's pretty significant income.
But there have been extraction failures, correct?
There have, yeah. And actually, Cook Inlet Keeper, and we've been around since 1995, and we were actually started because of spills that had happened in the inlet. So when we'll talk in a little bit about Hillcorp, who is the company that is currently working in Cook Inlet. But there were Unocal and BP and some other oil companies that were working in the inlet years ago, and they had so many Clean Water Act violations that when they were brought to court by a bunch of local folks, the court decided that the best way to kind of put a stop to the all of the violations was to actually have a citizens group that was paying attention. And so they helped start Cook Inlet Keeper as a sort of a watchdog on the oil and gas industry. And so there was the settlement ended up being 3 years of startup funding for Cook Inlet Keeper. Mm-hmm. And so that was back in 1995 was when we started. So, our relationship with oil and gas has been throughout our entire history here as an organization. And, you know, there were like over 4,000 violations. So there were definitely some issues in the early years. And what we're finding now, we've had a number of leaks from the aging infrastructure. So a lot of the pipelines that were put in originally back in the 60s are the same pipelines that are still transporting our oil and gas now. And these are subsea, so they're on the on the bottom of the ocean. Sometimes they're buried, but sometimes they're mostly just on top. And this is a really dynamic place, right? We have huge tides here, mm-hmm. and we have ice cover and winds, and but also we have these glaciers that are contributing a great deal of sediment into Cook Inlet, and all of that abrasive sediment is sort of working on these pipelines as the tides go back and forth. And we've had, over the last 10 years, we've had some significant cracks in pipelines that have led to a lot of, the leaks have often been for the gas pipelines.
And so what has been
bubbling up of methane, contributing to our climate problems.
Mm-hmm. So is there some accountability there when that happens? Is someone held accountable?
Well, I think you could get different answers from different people. Mm-hmm. My sense is that when and if they are ever fined for some of these violations, and sometimes they only know about them because somebody is flying over and we'll see bubbling coming up from mm-hmm. the bottom, mm-hmm. And then they know they have a leak, they tend to be pretty small fines that they get. And so I don't think that there's been proper accountability mm-hmm. for... Mm-hmm. You know, they're taking the people's resources and making a profit off of them. So mm-hmm. when they despoil the public waters, they ought to be held accountable. And I think that's something that across the country is really a problem that we don't tend to enforce and hold industry accountable for their failures.
And it makes it really complicated. If people are getting money from that, I mean, it makes it complicated. Do mm-hmm. you know, how much do we want to hold them accountable when we could get $1,000 this year or whatever? I think that makes it really hard.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, and certainly it becomes a political tool. You know, if as mm-hmm. a governor or as a legislator, you can give someone a bigger dividend, they're much more likely to vote for you, right? Mm-hmm. And so it does become quite a pawn in the in the political game. And, you know, this has been going on for a long time, and mm-hmm. I think if we were not having a climate crisis, that we probably would go on in that very awkward mm-hmm. dance mm-hmm. in perpetuity. But the reality is that we can no longer afford mm-hmm. to just take our dividend and go... and then, you know, enjoy our bike rides. Like, we don't have mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. luxury any longer. And especially in Alaska, where we're seeing anywhere from 2 to 4 times the rate of change in our climate up here. I mean, it's really dramatic. You can see the glaciers, you know, receding in, mm-hmm. in a very, you know, in a few years, you can go back to the same glacier and you could see the difference in how much ice is left.
Yeah.
You can feel it in our changing temperatures in the summertime. Like people, I like to think of like the fishermen know deep down that these changes are happening because they are now wearing smaller like thickness of their wetsuit to stay, mm-hmm. you know, their waders don't have mm-hmm. to be as thick anymore because the water's just not as cold. And, mm-hmm. you know, these little things in our days that we really can feel it. And so we can't afford to just take our money and run. We mm-hmm. have to face mm-hmm. the fact that things are changing rapidly and that we need to get off of fossil fuels.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Sue Mauger. She's the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, which is protecting the inlet, which spreads south of Anchorage, a huge area. Let's, Sue, if we could turn to the current push for oil leases. How and why have new lease auctions been authorized, and what's going on? We know that one took place just a week and a half ago.
Right. So, well, as I mentioned, the oil and gas development has been going on in state waters in Upper Cook Inlet since the 50s. But Lower Cook Inlet, which is part of the federal Outer Continental Shelf planning area, so federal waters, still is completely free of platforms and pipelines and infrastructure. But every 5 years, the federal government, and this is through the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, we usually call it BOEM. So the Bureau puts out a five-year plan so that the industry knows where the leases will be and can make plans. And so the sale that happened on December 30th was the last gasp of the 2017-2022 five-year plan. And this is lease sale 258, and it was to offer up over 1 million acres of Lower Cook Inlet for new exploration and development. Those exact same waters that federal managers had closed the fishery because of climate change, they are offering oil and gas leases. So the irony is thick. And so they this the sale 258 was on the books to happen, and it was it was originally the environmental impact statement process started in the last months of the Trump administration back in 2019, and they moved very quickly. It was one of the fastest impact statements that had ever been put together in a couple months. And they announced the sale was going to happen in the first days of 2020. And then when President Biden took over, one of the first things that he did was to pause all of the federal offshore oil and gas lease sales. And so we cheered here, and we're glad to see that. And then it went to court, of course. And then it's about a year ago in 2021, at the end of 2021, BOEM came back out with a revised environmental impact statement. And we worked with so many partners up here to try to let BOEM know that we really did not want this lease sale, that we have moved on and we are ready to begin really committing to renewable energy. And so we helped with lots of partners around the country. There was like almost 93,000 comments were put into BOEM, and 99.2% of them were opposed to this lease sale. So it was this amazing grassroots effort to let the federal government, let them know where Americans are and Alaskans are on leasing oil and gas. And they canceled the sale in May of 2020. They said that there was no industry interest, and they just canceled it. And again, we cheered.
Who canceled it?
And
the government?
Like, we were all done. And then in August, the Inflation Reduction Act passed. And, you know, for many people, they saw this as a really powerful and good climate bill that had real steps forward in our move and shift towards renewables. However, Senator Manchin was instrumental in getting lease sale 258 back on the block. And so BOEM had no choice and had to go ahead and offer the sale before the end of the year. And so that's the sale that we saw on December 30th.
Nevertheless, in December, you and others sued to stop. Tell us a little bit about the lawsuit and where that stands.
Sure. So so BOEM went ahead and finalized their environmental impact statement, which they had not finalized in the spring before they canceled the sale. And so they sort of rushed because they were forced to by the Inflation Reduction Act to get that done so they could meet the timeline to get the lease done before the end of the year. But in that effort to rush up tying up that statement, they really did not do their due diligence in terms of the analysis of climate impacts from the sale. It didn't provide a real evaluation of potential alternatives, which is an important part of the NEPA process, and the environmental impact statement should really be outlining significantly different alternatives to the original plan. And what they did was sort of like they reduced a few leases over, you know, a few blocks over here and a few blocks over here, but they were still pretty much offering a million acres of Lower Cook Inlet, as opposed to, you know, deciding to really carve out some significant parts of that. And we feel like that's not a real evaluation of, you know, tweaking the edges versus like real exploration of the options that that might be reasonable weren't done. So we decided to sue, and we decided to do that before the lease sale happened. We didn't ask for the sale to be canceled like before it happened, but because we really had no idea if there was going to be any industry interest. But we did ask the lawyers to go ahead and announce it before the sale, so that anybody who was going to go after those leases understood that this was going to be, that we were going to be taking them right to court. And actually, we're not taking the industry to court. We're taking the federal government to court. So, and their analysis.
I was going to clarify briefly for our listeners. I was confused. The leases are described in terms of acreage, which this is not dry land acreage. This is acreage out to sea. And confused me for a little bit as I was thinking about the whole process of the leases.
It's acres. They're blocks on the water. And then, of course, there's hundreds of feet of water below that. So it's actually quite a mass of area that could be potentially impacted by a spill, which I will add, one of the things that's pretty dramatic in the environmental impact statement is that their modeling shows a 1 in 5 chance of a major oil spill with new development. 1 in 5. Those are terrible odds.
Oh my gosh.
And that's, you know, that's in the statement. And so,
they admit
dramatic.
That outright. They admit that this is a potential disaster.
Exactly. And this is, you know, these are communities that all experienced the Exxon Valdez oil spill, right? Yeah. That oil, which was in Prince William Sound, which is sort of the next region over, that all came around and into Cook Inlet. And so these are people who spent time washing rocks, who couldn't eat the food out in front of their village, who really were impacted by it, and maybe, you know, in health as well. So, you know, a 1 in 5 chance of that happening again, you know, that's why we had so many people willing to speak out against this.
Yes. Let's not keep our listeners in suspense any longer. What happened next? What happened with the leases?
Well, so we were here holding our breaths at 10 o'clock on December 30th. This is the last Friday of the year, and wondering which way this was going to go. And there was a very dramatic, guy up on stage, you know, announcing what had happened. And in the end, one company bid for one of the 193 blocks. So basically, it was a flop. There clearly is no industry interest. I'm not exactly sure why Hillcorp decided to go after one. It seemed like it was sort of a saving face move. I don't know, there clearly is not interest in the Lower Cook Inlet. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that the geology is really different in the lower inlet. And apparently in what little exploration has happened out there, they hold the studies pretty close to their chest. So we're not exactly sure, but it suggests that the geology is not good for having big reserves of oil and gas down there. So we expect that that's one of the reasons why the interest was so low. And then the Hilcorp is, you know, this is sort of outside of their business plan. They are a company that comes in as a oil and gas field is dwindling, and they kind of wring the last little bits out of it. They are not a big exploration and development, you know, new development type of organization, company. And so these leases are really for, like, creating all of the new infrastructure that would be required for a whole new area that was being developed. So that's not really Hilcorp's thing. I think there's also a lot of, you know, market uncertainty. The future of oil and gas is very unclear to everyone. And so investing these, you know, this would take 10 plus years before they would be producing anything. Who knows what, you know, what our carbon story will be at that point and how much it'll cost them, or how little, you know, Alaskans would be willing to pay for knowing that there are other options out there.
So that bid was accepted? I mean, they own that little chunk?
Well, so BOEM has 90 days, and they evaluate the bids, and they get to decide if... they have 90 days to decide if there are any, like, antitrust considerations, or and making sure that there's a fair market value that was offered for the lease. And so they have, and these leases were sold for $64,000 for about 5,690 acres. So they're paying about... $27 per acre, or sorry, per hectare. So it's and unfortunately, that is how cheap our public lands and waters goes for in these lease sales.
So can they withdraw the bid, or are they now?
Yeah, Hilcorp could withdraw.
Okay.
BOEM could also deny it.
Okay.
They could decide that since the you know, with the lawsuit, they could agree that their environmental impact statement did not meet the standards, and that any lease that was purchased through that EIS process should be negated. And, you know, BOEM has a lot, you know, they were forced by Congress to hold the sale, but they have a lot of latitude for whether they actually accept the bid.
Okay.
That was not mandated.
Okay.
So yeah, they have a little bit of wiggle room there.
So will there be more auctions? Are they going to go forward with these plans, or are they getting a picture now?
So as all of this drama was going on this year with Lease Sale 258, BOEM also then in July... put out their next five-year plan, so the 2023 to 2028offshore oil and gas lease program plan was out for review, and it included 10 sale leases in the Gulf of Mexico and one lease sale in Cook Inlet. And so as we were trying to rally the troops around Lease Sale 258, we were also rallying our community around this five-year plan and trying to get President Biden and Interior Secretary Holland to remove Cook Inlet, actually to get rid of all oil and gas leasing, including the ones in the Gulf of Mexico, but to certainly, especially now that there's so little industry interest, to just get rid of the sale. Our communities are exhausted by this.
Oh,
it's very stressful. People get very worked up and very concerned, and it's time to just get rid of that program and invest in all the new exciting, you know, like I mentioned, we have such incredible tidal power here. We have geothermal, we have wind, we have solar, we have it all here, and it's just such a smack in the face when they try to tell us that they're still a future in oil and gas here. So
I wanted to comment too on
we
the
we are petitioning them to pull Cook Inlet out.
Yeah.
I was just reading today about your tides, that the inlet is second only to the Bay of Fundy in terms of potential for wave power, wave generation of electricity, which people have been talking about for a long time.
Yep.
And you also have
amazing things. There's amazing wind resources. There's both tidal and wave energy power. Lots of opportunity.
And you have a petition on your website. It's a great website that people can sign to urge termination of the whole plan. So listeners can go on. We'll give that website toward the end of the program, but people can go there and sign the petition as well. But I was also puzzled. So State of Alaska will continue with its leases. Are you taking action against those as well?
Yeah, so the state waters of Cook Inlet is where all this infrastructure is, and we'd much rather Hillcorp took that $64,000 it just bid on those leases and instead invested that in, like, fixing up the existing pipelines, and that would get a better use of their money. But so there is, the state has, and Hillcorp actually got six blocks in the sale that happened right before the federal sale. And that's basically, that oil and gas is what is being used locally for people for heating fuel and to also electrify our grid. So we understand that the transition to renewable energies is going to take some time, and that we don't want to be putting people out in the cold. And so we have not been trying to stop the state sales until there's been enough investment generally by the federal government to really jumpstart these other industries. So, we have to be reasonable that people do still need oil and gas. And so where infrastructure exists, we feel that for some amount of time, that's reasonable to continue to use as we build other options, and that we don't, at this late in the last gasp of the oil and gas era, that we don't suddenly industrialize a whole new area that is already, so wild and beautiful and beloved by the people that are here and that visit here. So, you have to pick your battles.
That's right, and it's always complicated. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Sue Mugger. She's the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, which is fighting to prevent federal leasing of oil and gas extraction and helping work on alternatives.
And you, Sue, so you had a degree in fisheries from from Duke University, and you're
actually from Oregon State. Undergrad as a Dukie, and then went to Oregon State for my master's work, and have been here 22 years doing science in our salmon streams.
Tell us some more about that. Unless there's anything else to say about the oil leases, I want to really hear about your other work and the work of the Inlet Keeper.
Yeah, sure. So, just as you said, Susan, it's all very complicated, right? And so we need to, try to stop the things that we can that are really leading us in the wrong direction. But we also want to find ways to lead towards solutions and also, be real. The climate crisis is happening, and it's going to unfold on some time scale and impact our environment. And so what do we do about it? And so one of the things that we've been working on for years, we learned early when I came and began working here at Cook Inlet Keeper back in 2000, we were just at the end of a spruce bark beetle infestation that had happened here.
Right.
So all of our trees were dying. It was pretty dramatic. And these aren't invasive species. These are species of beetle that live here. But we started to have really warm and dry summers. And mm-hmm. beetles love warm and dry. Mm-hmm. And so they just exploded in numbers. And they basically devastated our local forest. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people really rely on our salmon resource, which is, a real blessing up here that we still have really healthy salmon mm-hmm. populations, to the most part, not all of them. But people were very worried about what does it mean to your salmon stream if your forest dies. And mm-hmm. so when I came up, that was kind of the question I was asked to explore with my stream and fisheries background. So I started looking at the water quality and how that might be changing. And something that we discovered early on is that our stream temperatures were warming. And unlike what I maybe thought was happening, which was, the forest was dying, and so there was more solar input, and so the streams were warming because the trees were dying. Instead, what I found is that the streams were warming for the same reason that the trees were dying, which is that we were just getting warmer and drier up here. And so that was sort of the first local glimpse for me that climate change was really beginning to show itself. And so over the last 20 years, we've collected a lot of data all over the state, looking at how temperatures are changing in our salmon streams. And of course, salmon are cold water fish. And so the warmer the water gets, the more stressed they get, and they become much more susceptible to pollution, predation, and disease. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not one who likes to just catalog the demise of something, right? There's no joy in that, to just be tracking how things are changing without doing anything. So we started to look at, well, what can we do to help these salmon streams stay as cold as possible? And that's led us to this really neat technology that we use now to find pockets of cold water in these rivers. So it's thermal imagery that we have flown from an airplane or helicopter. And it gives us basically this really cool color map of the temperatures of the river. And that helps us find really important spring systems and places where groundwater, which is much colder than our surface water, mm-hmm. where that's entering into a river. And, as more and more people come up to our beautiful Alaska, we're going to see increasing pressure on mm-hmm. our watersheds and people wanting to be right on the river. And so by understanding, the value of riparian streamside vegetation and these spring systems and keeping the development pressure back from that, we can really help keep these rivers as cold as possible, that we don't add any additional stresses mm-hmm. to them. So this technology has been a really neat way to find those really critical places to help keep the rivers cold.
So you use this infrared imaging to find out mm-hmm. where the good places for salmon to be. So is development the stress that's placed on those that makes it warmer or makes it unhabitable? Or, is development...
So if you intercept that groundwater, like with roads, or you put your house on top of the spring, or you do things that really change that piping system underground, you will really influence how much of that groundwater gets to the river. And so really trying to keep as the pressure away from the places where that groundwater intersects with the river channel is really important. And, in some places, we have setbacks on a lot of our mm-hmm. rivers, and that's great. But in some places, a 50-foot setback isn't enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so trying to figure out, where do we need it to be wider? And can we work with that landowner, whether it's, the state or a private landowner, and help them understand the value of their property? And everybody loves salmon here, so everyone's sort of receptive to the idea that they could do something good for salmon, and that's something that they'd consider doing. And so then we can work with them with partners on conservation easements, or if there's restoration needs or some kind of land designation change. So it's really about, you know, getting these things mapped so that we're not working in ignorance of how these streams function and where those critical places are.
Right, right. And you're finding that developers or the government are receptive to the data that you provide. I mean, we're having some stresses here on a development. I do this every show. I find a way to talk about the problems that we have here. But we're finding stresses to the environment, including the salmon that we have here. And we have the data, but we find developers and government people to be resistant to the data.
So, and I think that's something that, you know, like, I think we all like to stick our head in the sand a little bit. So even when the data is sitting there, if it's going to require a real change in the way we think, we tend to be resistant to it. And so, you know, this is about, like with everything, building relationships with people. And you know, the fact that our organization has been here for a long time, and I've been here for a long time, and I know these people, and you just, like, build relationships so that they trust that what you're offering with the data is, you know, the best intention for everybody involved, including the salmon, but also including the people. And I think it's also being a bit relentless in you know, bringing this stuff forward and finding more and more places to bring the message to decision makers. But it is the crux of the challenge, right?
Yeah.
Like, we often are like, absolutely, well, we don't have the data. Well, even if you have the data, it's still really challenging to make that be impactful in decision making spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
We wanted to hear a little bit, we're almost out of time, but you also work for Strong Communities, Food Hubs, Climate Action, and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that and how that fits into Cook Inlet Keeper's agenda.
Yeah, well, our strategy is that we're building the good at the same time that we're trying to stop the
yes.
harm.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really, you know, kind of along the same lines of those building relationships and building community, we've been working to help build a local food community and economy up here. So one of the interesting changes that we've had up here as our climate has warmed is that it also has made small agriculture more possible. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of up here, we call them, they're like a hoop house. It's a, I'm totally spacing on the name of the word. it's like a little greenhouse that folks use, a high tunnel. That's what I'm trying to think of.
High tunnel.
Use hoop houses. And so people with, you don't even need a lot of property, but they can put a high tunnel up, and suddenly, you know, our days are so long that if they can keep the ground warm enough, they can get incredible growth. And so we have people who are just basically farming in these high tunnels, and you know, we have 19 hours of daylight in the summer, so you can almost literally watch things grow. It's just incredible in July. And so we have this whole local food movement, and we've helped to encourage farmers markets around the region. And then we've also, and we did it just before COVID, and we didn't know how good a move that was, because we basically started to create an online farmers market where a lot of the farmers had more vegetables than they could sell once a week at the farmers market.
Wow.
So we created another way for them to sell locally. And then, of course, when COVID hit, online shopping became quite a wonderful solution, and so we actually, that grew exponentially and is an important source of local produce for a lot of folks still. So that's been really exciting to, like, think about the solutions and, you know, how do we sort of decentralize all of these systems that we've created that have been created for maximum production, but not for equity and not for, you know, real local issues. Mm-hmm. And so trying to break down some of our systems and figure out how we can, the people can take back a little bit more of the focus and control of those. And so that's been our food work. And then we also have been doing this series of climate action programs, which we, I don't know if you know the book Drawdown.
Mm-hmm.
So that we've used that as our guide. And Drawdown is basically looking at, like, how do we literally draw down carbon? Like, not just, like, slow down our emissions, but we actually draw down the carbon mm-hmm. Emissions. And so we've taken that to a real local level and said, okay, so, you know, what are the benefits of composting? Does that actually locally bring down our carbon? What about, you know, if we were to change the infrastructure around our roads and make them more bikeable and walkable, mm-hmm. how would that change our carbon output?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've, like, really dived into these as real math problems and built a lot of community around that. And we've got retreeing efforts in some neighborhoods. We have done a big solarize campaign to do a shared, like, bunch of people work together to get a lower price for solar panels,
mm-hmm.
things like that. So really being local and solution-oriented, and that really brings an awful lot of people together. And, you know, anytime you can do that, you're doing good.
Thank you so much. A lot of inspiring work you're doing, hard work. I know how hard it is, and we really appreciate your sharing what you've done. And we will direct people to your website, which is
inletkeeper.org.
inletkeeper.org to learn about all of your work. Our guest has been Sue Mauger. She's the director of the Cook Inlet Keeper, and yeah, we really appreciate
you.
Yes, I actually needed to hear you tonight, so this is really good to hear about your inspirational work. So thank you so much for being with us, Sue.
Well, thank you both. Appreciate the interest and the opportunity to share what we're doing up here. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We're on the web. We'll have Sue's interview up with us up on the website in a day or so. And you can always check out our previous programs there. That's ecotopiakzfr.com. We're always eager to get comments from our listeners. So anytime you have a suggestion for a new program, things you'd like to cover, things you might disagree with, this is, after all, community radio, and it's public opinionated radio at the same time. So thank you for listening. Coming up at just a few moments, it's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. She'll be interviewing Vicki Wolf and Amy Fitzgerald Dewar about Vitalant Blood Source. This has been Ecotopia. Thanks so much for listening.
You are the new day. You are the new day. I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are the new day.
Around me where they fall. Earth State Give and Take is made possible by the Butte College, where your future starts with three-week classes beginning January 3rd. Are offered online at the Butte College main campus or the Chico Center. If you can't join this winter, spring classes include cosmetology and barbering at the main campus, Chico and Skyway Centers, and their new Glenn County Center in Orland. Promise scholarships are also available for first and full-time students. Details at butte.edu/start. And by the printed image, providing screen printing and